From NPR and WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. After a contentious few months of battles between teachers' unions, lawmakers, and health officials, school districts throughout the country are now in a race to make COVID-19 vaccines available to teachers and school employees. It's all part of this massive effort to get kids back in school. Here's President Biden.
We want every educator, school staff member, child care worker to receive at least one shot by the end of the month of March.
Teachers, President Biden says, will now also qualify to participate in the federal pharmacy vaccination program. Let's check in with the second largest public school system in the country, Los Angeles School Unified, which just announced it will vaccinate teachers and school staff with a goal of opening elementary and preschools by mid-April. LA Unified Superintendent Austin Buettner joins us now with how this will all work. Welcome.
Tanya, thanks for having me.
Yes, thank you for being here. There's over 86,000 people who work for LA Unified. Who's going to get first priority?
What we're focused on first is those in schools who serve the needs of our youngest learners, our elementary schools, our early education centers, students with learning differences and disabilities, and all who work at those schools. It's not just the classroom teacher. It's the bus driver who takes students to school. It's the principal who unlocks the front door. It's the custodian who keeps the school clean and safe. So it's a team at a school. We want to make sure the teams who are supporting our youngest learners will help first. We've reached an extraordinary partnership with the state to accelerate the pace of accelerations. We hope to have that, We hope to have that done in a matter of a week or 10 days. We've set up the capability at school sites and together with our partners, the Rams and SoFi Stadium, the first mass vaccination site exclusively for educators. So we're going to do this as quickly as we can, as safely as we can to help get students back to the classroom.
And April 9th is when you're aiming to open these elementary schools and centers. Why was it important to start at the elementary level?
Well, we know students do best in a classroom setting. And we know for many students, the absence from a classroom setting, they've struggled. Those students for whom it's been most acute are youngest learners, those with differences and disabilities, and students who might have been struggling before. So we want to bring them back as soon as possible and as safely as possible. And throughout, we've said that takes the appropriate health standards and practices at schools, which we think we're exceeding. We have changed the air filtration system in 80 million square feet of buildings to replace the filters with the equivalent N95 filter. We test all students, all staff every week with a PCR COVID test. And now vaccination completes that to allow us to bring back all as soon as possible and in the safest way possible.
You mentioned some of the efforts on the state level. Governor Gavin Newsom is also offering financial incentives for all California schools that reopen by the end of this month. And as I mentioned, the president just announced teachers now qualify for this federal pharmacy vaccination program. How does your program work with this new federal opportunity for teachers? Do all of these efforts kind of work in concert with each other, or does it actually make the process more convoluted?
Well, I think what we're seeing for the first time is a whole of government response. We've been advocating for some time the three pillars: health practices at schools, lower COVID in the communities that we serve, which has been the hardest hit in the nation, and vaccination for school staff. And we're really pleased to see the federal government, the state government, and those of us who work in schools all aligned with a common understanding that the safest possible environment includes vaccinations for all who work in schools.
Teachers' unions have been a big part of pushing for these vaccinations to happen before teachers and others go back into the classroom. I mean, it's something that the state and the CDC actually says is not a requirement. So there's a real push and pull here. What are you hearing from teachers' unions about this latest effort?
Well, we've been side by side with those who work in schools in advocating for this. Our community that we serve have been amongst the hardest hit in the nation. We serve more than 80% of the families that we serve live in poverty before the pandemic came. As many as three quarters have lost work. These are the Black and Latino communities who are essential workers who have been hardest hit by COVID. So with high levels of COVID, communities that have been hard hit, we think the right thing is to make sure we support the community, we support our students, and we support our educators in schools with the vaccination. I wish it was happening faster. I wish it had happened already, but we're at this point now where we can go forward together. Let's do it the right way. And when we talk about returning to schools as soon as possible, safely as possible, we're not returning in any way possible. We're returning in the safest way possible, and that includes vaccinations for school staff.
We also know that reopening schools is as much about economics as it is about education. What has navigating all of these forces been like for you and your team? I mean, there's a lot of considerations that come into play, and it's not all about educating our children.
We've had to balance three things throughout. We've had to balance the learning needs of students, where educators are doing extraordinary things with the online tools. We've had to balance the needs of working families that we support and the safety net we provide for them. And we've had to balance the health and safety of the school community, on which we cannot compromise. But along the way, we've tried to make sure that each of the three were doing the best possible thing we can. Safety net, for instance, we have provided more than 110 million meals to the students and families we serve, the largest single relief effort by any organization in the country. Not something we would have thought we'd be doing starting last March, but we're doing it because it's needed. We've provided 500,000 students, not just with a computer, but with internet access, because a quarter of our students couldn't connect to the internet. Their families couldn't afford broadband when this crisis arose. So throughout, we've had to balance, Tanya, all three of those, and we're doing the best we can on each. We look forward to welcoming students back, and the foundation that we're building will help us do that.
That's Los Angeles Unified School District Superintendent Austin Buettner. Superintendent, thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
President Biden is just hours away from having another cabinet member in place. The Senate has confirmed former Rhode Island Governor Gina Raimondo as Commerce Secretary. And one of her top responsibilities will be to oversee the 2020 census, which is not over yet. We're joined by NPR national correspondent Hansi Luong, who covers all things census-related. And Hansi, for people who aren't familiar with Gina Raimondo, tell us a bit about her.
Gina Raimondo is the first woman to lead Rhode Island and just resigned yesterday as the governor of the country's smallest state, cutting short her second term hours after the Senate voted to confirm her nomination. And Raimondo is expected to defer to the expertise of career staffers at the Census Bureau, which would be unlike what the Trump administration did. Officials in the previous administration went against Census Bureau career officials by pushing to add a citizenship question, if you remember, and ending counting early for last year's census. And all this history was alluded to during Raimondo's Senate confirmation hearing back in January. Let's listen to what Raimondo said.
I commit to taking the politics out of census, relying on expertise, and doing everything I can to rebuild people's trust in the census. It needs to be accurate.
You know, getting accurate and complete data from the 2020 census, that's going to be a major challenge that Raimondo is inheriting as Commerce Secretary.
And Hansi, you've been reporting on these challenges facing the headcount. So where do things stand with the census right now?
Well, because of the pandemic and last-minute schedule changes made under the Trump administration, there are now major delays in releasing the census results. The Census Bureau says it needs more time to run quality checks, so they've pushed back releasing the first set of results, the state population counts that determine how many votes each state gets in the House of Representatives and in Electoral College. Those numbers were due at the end of last year. They are now expected by the end of April. And there's about a six-month delay for the second set of census results. That's the detailed demographic data states need to redraw voting districts around the country. Those are due by the end of this month. But the Bureau recently announced it's pushed back that release to late September.
Okay, I mean, that's a lot of schedule changes, Hansi. And I know that some states are supposed to start redrawing their voting maps this year. So what do these delays mean for them?
It puts a lot of state and local officials in charge of redistricting, redrawing those voting maps in a real bind because they have their own deadlines to prepare for elections this year or next. And, you know, some states started preparing last year when the Census Bureau first signaled back in April 2020 that this redistricting data would be late because of the pandemic. Last summer, California State Supreme Court granted deadline extensions for finalizing new voting maps. And in New Jersey, there was a ballot referendum that passed in November to amend the state constitution so they can delay drawing new maps by 2 years. The state of Ohio is taking a unique approach. It filed a lawsuit against the Census Bureau last week, trying to get a federal judge to order redistricting data to be released by the end of this month. Now, based on the Census Bureau's current schedule, that's just not possible. The Bureau needs to get the first set of census results out, the apportionment counts. Those need to come out first. And those, again, are not expected until April 16th at the earliest.
I see. So what exactly are these quality checks then that the Bureau is using the extra time for?
Well, after counting ends for a census, there are usually duplicate and incomplete responses the Census Bureau has, and it needs time to sort through those. And this time, one of the challenges is that the Census Bureau collected online responses for the first time from all households. And some that was available to all households, and some of those responses did not have Bureau-assigned ID codes to help with matching to home addresses. Plus, during the early months of the pandemic, when the counting was really ramping up, a lot of people, especially college students, were moving around, and there was a lot of confusion about where to get counted. You know, one thing to keep in mind is that current federal law does say that redistricting data from the 2020 census, that data are due to states by March 31st, but there's a bipartisan group of senators who are planning to introduce a bill to formally extend that deadline to the end of September. It hasn't happened yet, and I'm watching to see when that happens.
Okay, we'll keep track of it with you. That's NPR's Hanzi Luong, who covers all things census-related. Hanzi, thanks for the latest.
You're welcome.
President Biden says there will be enough vaccines for every American adult by the end of May, 2 months earlier than expected. He's also urging states to give at least one vaccine dose to every teacher by the end of this month so schools can safely reopen. And to pay for it, and also help people struggling financially, Biden is calling on senators to quickly pass his $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief bill.
The bottom line is we need the American Rescue Plan now. Now. There is light at the end of the tunnel, but we cannot let our guard down now or assure that victory is inevitable. We can't assume that. We must remain vigilant, act fast and aggressively, and look out for one another.
President Biden there. Our political strategists join us now. Alice Stewart is a Republican. Bill Press is a Democrat. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Colin.
Hi, Colin.
Good to be here.
So light at the end of the tunnel is the president's phrase. And to be more specific, he says he hopes life is going to be back to normal a year from now. But that's if everyone remains vigilant. And meanwhile, states like Texas are moving to fully reopen and end mask restrictions now. So, Bill, if life isn't back to normal next year, in the midterm election cycle, by the way, who's going to bear the blame? Biden and the Democrats or Republicans like Texas Governor Greg Abbott?
Oh, no doubt, Biden and the Democrats will get the blame. That's the way the game is played. But I wouldn't be that negative, Kalaman, looking ahead. I think the administration has made significant progress in upping the number of vaccinations. They're way ahead of the timetable that they set. They're going to blow past 100 million in 100 days easily. And I do think that the president will be successful in getting the $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill, or very close to it, through the Senate. It's badly needed. The relief is badly needed, particularly for people who are the over 10 million Americans unemployed, for small businesses, especially for restaurants, to help with the vaccination process. Here's what I don't understand. I don't understand why the Republicans in the Senate are, you know, as a block, opposed to this bill. I mean, Republican governors support it. Republican mayors support it. A poll this morning showed that 53% of Republican voters support it, even if it doesn't have any Republican senators voting for it. So I don't get it. This is badly needed. The relief is needed. Just pass it. And I would hope with a bipartisan vote. But if not, I think Biden's right in just going ahead with 50 Democrats and Kamala Harris.
Okay, well, I maybe you meant that as a rhetorical question, Bill Press, but I have someone who can help answer your question about why Republicans won't support it. Here's Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell predicting that no Republican is going to vote for it, and here's why.
This is a wildly expensive proposal, largely unrelated to the problem. About 9% of the money is in the healthcare space. Less than 1% of it deals with vaccinations.
All right, Alice, translate a little bit there. I mean, are Mitch McConnell and Republicans saying that nothing else needs to be done to help get through the pandemic?
What he's saying is that COVID relief needs to be timely and targeted on COVID relief and not progressive and Democrat wish lists. And as McConnell said, only 9% of this nearly $2 trillion package actually goes for pandemic relief, and that is just not acceptable. And we need to look at what is pressing and what is timely and important for the American people, and that is getting the relief where it needs with regard to the pandemic. And I will say this, I think it's important that the money gets out there and allocated in the right way, but also the vaccines making the progress. And I will give this to President Biden. Bill, listen here. I will give him props because I am encouraged with his announcement that with the key milestone that every American will have vaccinations available in a shorter period than originally thought. That is, I think, a tribute to the commitment of this current administration, and it cannot go unnoticed.
Yeah. Thank you, Alice, for that.
Go ahead, Bill. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I just want to point out, look, I think Mitch McConnell is just all wet. $25 billion in here goes to restaurants that are really struggling. A lot of all of us, our favorite places, have shut down. There are $1,400 checks, which even Donald Trump supported for families that need it. There's expanded unemployment insurance. There's a vaccination program. What do you mean this isn't related? It's all related to COVID.
Okay, well, $135 million for the National Endowment for the Arts, $135 million earmarked for Endowment for Humanities, $200 million for the Institute of Museum and Library Services. I could go on, but we can certainly talk about other things. So it's inaccurate to say this was all about COVID.
Then I think Republicans should.
I do want to come back to the
and,
key figure, though, because Bill, you mentioned those $1,400 checks, and I do think when it comes to everyday Americans who are listening, that's really what they care about. And today we have news that Senate Democrats have reached an agreement with the White House, because, by the way, it wasn't just Republicans who had some objections to the House version here. And so the amount of the full checks remains at $1,400 in this compromise, but they're going to phase out at lower income levels. So now individuals earning $80,000 or more, or couples earning $160,000 or more, they won't get anything, and they were going to get partial payments before. So, Bill, is this the kind of compromise needed to get the bill over the finish line?
Yes, I think it's a good move. I think it shows, again, that unlike the former president, this president is working with members of Congress, even members of his own party, in trying to forge a compromise. And again, I would say if Republicans have ideas, come to the table. But they have not. They have not come with any counterproposal except a $600 billion, which is less than one-third of what Biden originally put up. They're just not serious. I think they're making a big mistake. The American people want this. And I think they're going to get it.
All right. If the Democrats can come to a deal, they will be able to pass this bill on a party line vote using the budget reconciliation process. But I do want to talk a little bit about a minor loss, but a loss on the early ledger for the Biden administration. And that is the withdrawal of Neera Tanden as the nominee to lead the Office of Management and Budget. She had posted some mean tweets about Republicans and some Democrats. Alice Stewart, what went wrong here, and what's the takeaway?
Well, to say that it's only about mean tweets is not accurate, because while there were a lot of Republicans and some Democrats who were concerned about her mean tweets, it was more than that. And I think Senator Collins addressed that, and others have, was that Neera Tanden did not have the experience or the temperament to lead the agency, specifically because this administration had made it clear that the Office of Management and Budget was going to be big and bold more than in years past. And based on Tanden's previous tweets and actions and talk, they didn't feel her temperament was fitting of such a big and bold agency. So that was a big part of it. It was more about policy than tweets.
Yeah, but just to jump in, I mean, didn't Republicans here, though, who were criticizing Neera Tanden, didn't they overlook much worse from the former president, who was more vitriolic on Twitter and had never held elected office before he became president?
Absolutely. You're right about that. And to say that there's a hypocrisy, there certainly is. But that being said, members of the Senate in this instance are in the personnel business. They are in a position to hire people that they feel, or to appoint people they feel, have the temperament to hold these important jobs. With regard to Donald Trump, the American people in 2016 voted him into office. And that is why a lot of the senators and members of Congress and others put up with his tweets, as mean as they were, because that was the will of the American people.
Bill Press, let me ask you about what I think is an even bigger trouble within your party, which is the Andrew Cuomo situation in New York. And last night, one of that state senators, Kirsten Gillibrand, called the sexual harassment allegations by three women against Cuomo completely unacceptable. But she didn't say Cuomo should resign. He is being investigated. How complicated is this situation for Democrats, Bill?
I don't think it should be as complicated as some people are making it. Speaking for myself, I'm consistent in this, that the allegations of sexual harassment, sexual assault are wrong no matter who is targeted or is the subject of them, no matter which political party. I think it was wrong for Donald Trump. Over two dozen women accused him of sexual assault. I think it's wrong for freshman Congressman Madison Cawthorn. Some 30 students have accused him of sexual harassment or assault. And I think it's wrong for Andrew Cuomo. So certainly I think the investigations have to be taken seriously. And there should be an investigation at the minimum. I think, as a Democrat, the best thing for Andrew Cuomo could do is to step down and resign and get out of the way.
Alice, in the moment we have left, I mean, are Democrats waffling on this issue? They stood up and pushed out Al Franken pretty quick. Not so much here.
I see a lot of Democrats, 30 lawmakers in New York, have asked either for his resignation or to face impeachment. So they're taking this seriously. And it's important that we have an independent investigation to determine, is this a possible pattern of behavior with more to come? Or are these isolated incidents of allegations? And I think it's important to have a full investigation. He deserves due process. Although the allegations are damning, he does deserve due process. And at that point, after the investigation, certainly the appropriate actions should be taken.
All right. That's Republican strategist Alice Stewart. Thanks to you.
Thank you, Colin.
Thanks also to Democrat Bill Press.
Hey, Callum. Thanks so much. Thanks, Alice. Bye.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
When the survivors of a mass shooting at a newspaper went back to work, everything was different, even email.
What if someone's sending us more death threats? Or what if somebody sends me a death threat and I don't see it, and then somebody comes and kills all my friends and it's my fault because I didn't read the email?
That's this week on the Capital Gazette series from NPR's Embedded.
Air traffic controllers may soon be assisting more planes in the sky. That's because data from Cirium, the travel analytics firm, shows the number of flights scheduled in April is finally higher than a year ago by 111%, signaling the travel industry may be flying past the pandemic. To help us make sense of this data, we're joined by Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. Hey, Seth.
Hey, Tanya.
So around April 1st of last year, just to put this into context, airlines started slashing schedules. Now fast forward to this year and airlines are scheduling more flights. Does this mean airlines are actually responding to more demand?
They are. At the beginning, there was no amount of cutting they could do to basically keep up with the reduced demand, right? They cut all those flights, and yet flights were still empty. People heeding the warnings, mostly, of the CDC. And as you said, April last year was kind of the low water mark. So whereas this month in March, you look at schedules, they're still lighter than March of a year ago because airlines didn't know what was coming. Once you get into April, yeah, about twice as busy as the same month a year ago, which is not to say the busiest ever, because it's still less than what they were scheduling before the pandemic.
Right. And looking closer at this April data, scheduled seats are up at most major U.S. airports compared to 2020. What else sticks out to you about this?
Yeah, and among the top airports, you got one like Newark, let's say, which is up 941% looking at the data. And the reason for that would be its major airline, United, had cut a lot last year, and also a big international airport. Think about all the international flights that didn't happen. So no surprise that it would be up a lot. But then just down the road in Atlantic City, that airport is up 1,300% for April compared to a year earlier, again, based on seats scheduled.
You know, Seth, since the pandemic began, most airlines ease their cancellation policies. Are airlines still offering these refunds or waiving cancellation fees?
They are. Now, what you see some of them doing is not going as far into the future. So harder to say, you know, you'll have airlines say, hey, book by March 31st, that sort of thing. But as of now, basically, right, if you book a ticket on the airline, you're going to have that flexibility. And they've varied also in terms of the way they have reinstated their schedules. You know, I mentioned their Atlantic City Spirit is the main reason for that. That's the big airline in Atlantic City. It's way up, so the airport is up. An airline like Southwest, which hadn't cut as much early on, so it's not rebounding as much this April. No surprise that airports like Chicago Midway and Dallas Love Field, Tanya, are actually down compared to a year earlier, just by a bit, because those are airlines where Southwest is the big airline.
Oh, interesting. You know, flights are also pretty cheap right now. How quickly do you expect rates to rise as we all start traveling again?
Yeah, well, and that's what airlines want, right? They're always playing that same game, supply and demand economics, right? So when they're adding seats, it's because they think more people are going to travel. They think they're going to be able to fill up the flights and get some of those higher fares. And they're going to be pretty conservative about adding more seats until the fares start going up. Right. They're not trying to give us a good deal unless they have to, if that's what they have to do to get us onto the airplanes, as more of us get vaccinated and as travel restrictions ease in more and more states.
That's Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. As always, thank you.
Thanks, Tanya.
In the new Disney animated film, Raya and the Last Dragon, Raya is a young warrior in the fantasy land of Kumandra, where humans and dragons lived together for centuries. But an evil force known as Droon turned the dragons, and many of the humans, into stone. The remaining humans split into warring factions. Raya is on a mission to restore peace. Along the way, she manages to find the last surviving dragon, named Sisu.
Why are you here, Divine Water Dragon?
Isn't that obvious, big guy? My girl Raya and I are going to fix the world. Bring everyone back.
That's Awkwafina as the voice of the dragon Sisu. Raya and the Last Dragon opens in theaters and is available on Disney Plus beginning Friday. Kelly Marie Tran voices Raya in the film and joins us to talk about it. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for having me. This is so exciting.
Yeah, we're glad to have you, Kelly. And I got to tell you, I watched this movie with my young children, and they loved the music and the dragons and how vibrant all the scenes are. As a grown-up, though, watching a year into a global pandemic, I kind of related to the people who've been turned into stone, because right now this seems like a fitting movie for this moment when so many people feel like they've been stuck in place for a long time. And I wonder if you agree.
Yeah, I definitely feel like the filmmakers and I have talked about how incredible it is that the movie's coming out right now, because it feels really strangely relevant to this time. And, you know, of course, something like this takes so many years to develop that you can't really predict the world that it's going to be coming out in, if that makes sense. But yeah, it definitely feels really relevant to everything going on in the world.
So, pandemic or not, your character, Raya, is totally fearless. She doesn't hesitate to go into danger. And I wonder how much fun it is to play somebody like that.
So fun. I want to be more like her. I think that, you know, I always think to myself as an actor, if I'm not learning something, like a deep new core belief from every character I'm playing, then I'm probably doing it wrong. And I think one of the things that I've learned from Raya is that bravery can take many forms. You know, like she already was from the beginning a warrior, and then towards the end of the movie she shows bravery in a completely different way, and that to me is really inspiring.
Yeah, the brave thing, without giving away too much, is sort of having to take a chance on other people, which is kind of scary. And again, without giving away too much of the plot here, you know, an important part of Raya's mission in the film is to find all the missing pieces of a powerful dragon gem which was broken and try to put the whole thing back together. and she and the dragon Sisu collect the scattered pieces along the way. And as they do, each one has an effect on Sisu. So let's listen to a scene where they find one of the pieces.
You're glowing.
Oh, thank you. I use aloe and river slime to maintain my...
No. Look.
Oh, this is my little sister Appa's magic. I got the glow!
Your little sister's magic?
Yeah, every dragon has a unique magic.
Okay, what's yours?
I'm a really strong swimmer.
Wait. You touched this gem piece and it gave you powers. You know what this means, right?
I no longer need a nightlight.
What? No! You're still connected to the gem's magic. And that means you can still use it to save the world.
So I think what we hear there, Kelly, is this great chemistry between you and Awkwafina. But I'm curious about the mechanics of how you actually did this. I mean, did you actually get to record and act alongside Awkwafina? Or were you kind of each recording in a vacuum?
Yeah, we were each recording in a vacuum, unfortunately. I think it's the nature of animation, but also sort of escalated by the pandemic. So yeah, unfortunately, we didn't get to really interact with each other until we started doing press. But when we met via Zoom, it really did feel like we automatically had a banter. I think she's one of those people that sort of has chemistry with everyone. She's so infectious. Like, her energy is just incredible. And I think she's so talented. So I feel really grateful that I got to work with her, and I'm really excited that people are finding joy in their dynamic, these two characters.
Well, talented is an understatement, right? Because she's an actress and a rapper, and she's also a comedian, which I think is important for this role as Sisu the Dragon, because even though humans regard Sisu almost like a deity, like she's this legendary character, when we actually meet Sisu in the film, she's very funny, she's self-deprecating, she's kind of insecure, actually. So what do you think the film says about how we see our heroes and maybe the disconnect between that perception and reality?
Yeah, I think that that's a really good way to put it, because especially with the way that Raya also idolizes dragons as a kid. But I think what's really, really cool about their relationship and how it evolves as the movie goes on is that Raya really starts to recognize that even if her hero, Sisu, isn't exactly what she thought she would be, there are still wonderful and beautiful things about her. And I think that being able to sort of separate any sort of perception we have about a person and just really celebrate who they authentically really are, I think that's a really important aspect of their relationship, an important lesson that Raya learns for sure.
That our heroes can be imperfect and still be heroes.
Yeah.
You know, Kelly, this film is coming out as the country has been reckoning with several years of Me Too and Black Lives Matter movements. And there's been a reckoning going on in Hollywood as well. We've been talking about representation or sometimes lack thereof in Hollywood. And in this film, the heroes and their rivals, they're all women. They're played by actors who are of Asian descent. How important is it that we see films like this, especially films for our kids?
It's so important. I think, you know, we're taking a step forward towards having equal representation across gender identities, across race, across socioeconomic class. The more we're able to sort of educate ourselves on just the different experiences that human beings have, I think it makes us better people. It makes us more compassionate. You know, I think something the movie does really well is recognizing that there are divisions between groups of people, and maybe we need to look at why those divisions exist. So to me, it's really important to have a movie like this that is celebrating a part of the world that really isn't celebrated that often.
I have to ask you about Star Wars, because I think that's how many viewers know you until they see Raya and the Last Dragon. In the Star Wars franchise, you play Rose Tico, of course, the engineer in the two most recent films. What's it like to be part of such a legendary franchise?
Huge. I remember it feeling like a honor and a responsibility at the same time. It's not very different, actually, to how I feel about Raya. It just makes me have this sort of feeling of reverence, if that makes sense, and recognizing, I feel very humbled by these experiences to just acknowledge how much bigger they are than me and how much they will outlive me, you know? Yeah, it's definitely very big deals that I feel like I'm still trying to recognize that it's reality.
Getting cast in the Star Wars franchise, of course, is a big break. But, you know, it was also an experience in which I know that you saw what I think could fittingly be called the dark side of the Star Wars fan base. In fact, you got off Instagram after experiencing racist and sexist harassment. And then you wrote in the New York Times, it wasn't their words, it's that I started to believe them. And that was a few years ago. Have you been able to stop believing the cruel things that people sometimes say?
Yeah, I think I have. You know, I think it to exist in this world that for a lot of us is constantly telling us we don't belong. It's all of these subconscious ways in which the media, in which the world is reinforcing ideas into our brains of things that we need. You know, we need to buy this mascara to feel more beautiful so that we can be loved. We need to look more like this woman so that we are more desirable so that we can be loved. All of these lies that we're told. I think that it takes practice and constant fighting to remind yourself that sometimes it's not you that's the crazy one. Sometimes it's the world around you. And the ways in which we can recognize that we are enough just in who we are, I think that that is definitely something I've worked on over the last 3 years and something I continue to work on.
And, you know, overcoming that kind of interpersonal ugliness that you were just describing is a great way to come back to Raya and the Last Dragon, because for Raya and Sisu to repair their world, they actually have to learn to trust people who have wronged them and persuade others to do the same and to overcome their differences. Is that a message that the world needs right now?
Yes. Man, it's a message I know I need right now. I think the message of this movie about trust, about unity, about trying to look past the pain and the trauma that we've experienced in our lives and to take a step towards fighting for believing in a better world, I think that that's an incredible message that I know I want to take with me. And I hope that other people are able to see that and feel that as well through this movie.
That's Kelly Marie Tran, who stars in Raya and the Last Dragon. The film opens in theaters and is available on Disney Plus starting Friday. Kelly, this was fun, and the film's a lot of fun, too.
Thank you so much.
I don't know about you, but this past year has changed the way I use social media. For instance, it finally pushed me over the edge to quit Facebook. It just didn't feel useful or constructive. And it seems I'm not alone in changing my social media habits. Ronnie Mola is senior data reporter for Recode, and she's been writing about the significant changes we're seeing in what she calls pandemic posting. Hi, Ronnie.
Hey, Tanya.
So you heard from a lot of people who said they were using social media less, or at least posting less on their own accounts, because it kind of felt out of touch with the calamity of the pandemic. On the other hand, you also heard from some people who said the pandemic actually made them use social media more. What are you hearing?
Well, the data shows that people are spending more time on social media, sort of across the board, every different platform. The time spent last year was a lot less than it is this year. That said, the way people are interacting with social media seems to vary widely. You know, they might be on social media more, but they're scrolling and they're not posting because, you know, it sort of seems that it's inappropriate to post about anything. A lot of the things we used to post about, birthdays and going out to fancy dinners, things like that, you know, might be inappropriate or just not happening. Other people found it completely overwhelming. You know, they were getting stressed out. I spoke to a teacher who said that he was seeing a lot of other teachers post this sort of performative stuff when he was worried about his kids even being able to get online, not whether they could create like a Bitmoji classroom.
Mm-hmm. Let's parse out a little bit more about what this all actually means, though. So while social media for a while has been used as a way to connect and organize, this year in particular, we also saw groups like Black Lives Matter use social media and other methods to organize mass protests against police violence. I mean, for people who haven't completely dropped off of social media, did this past year change the kinds of posts that they're making? Maybe fewer personal stories that, as you mentioned, might feel frivolous, and instead more political activism?
Oh, absolutely. I think there's been tons of political activism, and a lot of people who hadn't been sort of political, at least, you know, on social media before, decided that, you know, they were going to say something this year. And obviously this is happening in the context of Black Lives Matter, people protesting against police violence. On the flip side of that, there's also the people who organized the Capitol riots use social media to sort of come together, you know, egged on by a president who was using Twitter to tell them to come and make their voices heard about what they thought was a stolen election.
lurking, as you mentioned, seems to be the biggest pastime right now as well. I mean, more folks are scrolling more, but posting less. Is this actually also a sign of burnout? Because as we talk about political organizing and activism and people speaking out on social media, we've kind of been dealing with that nonstop for several years now.
Yeah, I mean, even before the pandemic, we saw evidence that people were posting less original content, that, you know, the amount of time spent on social media was sort of plateauing. But then all of a sudden, you know, social media became the only way in which we could socialize. And it's been, you know, a year now, and that's exhausting. I talked to a lot of people who felt completely burnt out, who, you know, maybe for a while social media was a good proxy, but like after a while, it is not the same thing as actually getting to be face to face with your friends. So it left people feeling really wary.
What's so interesting about the data that you've collected as well is because social media is kind of the place where we connect with each other. The fact that we can't really connect with each other in the physical spaces right now kind of makes it a space that is very valued because you can check in on people. But how are people presenting their daily lives on social media without seeming frivolous?
So that was a really interesting thing that I heard from a lot of experts and a lot of just regular people. You know, social media has been long criticized for being this place of sort of perfection. And obviously that's not real life. One thing that sort of happened because of the pandemic is social media has become much more of a place for complaints and for real life and for, you know, talking about your problems. There's also an incredible amount of judgment right now on social media. The comments about how people are saying, oh, you know, what you should and shouldn't be doing, but also just people are aware when they're posting. They say, oh, I went and did this, but it was COVID safe. You know, it's almost this tick. So people know they're doing something that will be judged. And I absolutely think people are judging.
Do you think this is a significant flashpoint for the evolving nature of how we use social media? I'm thinking after this pandemic, I mean, will we go back to then everyone posting their travel pictures, for instance, because they can go out? Or are we going to be using social media in a more pointed or different way in the future?
You know, I'm not sure. One thing I did ask was whether, you know, we're going to like see this complete drop off. And the thing is about something like social media is it becomes a habit. You know, if you get used to opening an app umpteen times a day, you do that without noticing. So a lot of the people and data analysts I talked with didn't expect to see like a complete drop off in the amount of time spent on social media after we could go outside. That said, one person I spoke to referred to the summertime, you know, the possibility of being able to go outside as a potential reckoning for our relationship with social media. You know, maybe we won't do it as much or so pointedly when we could do something else.
Oh, it'll be interesting to see. Ronnie Mola is a senior data reporter for Recode. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now.